From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Merlin Project and the presidential elections. And by the way, happy birthday to radio legend and our friend Tom Likas. Happy birthday, Tom. Many, many more. Here's what's happening. Florida Governor Rick Scott has announced the number of Zika cases likely spread by local mosquitoes has now increased to 14 and has asked for federal emergency response teams to help the state combat the spread of the virus in the United States. But just how bad is this? Let's check in with the expert on pandemics, Dr. Gary Ridenour. Gary, tell us about this Florida situation.
Well, this is kind of an interesting situation. 14 cases in one section of Miami. No one traveled out of the country. No one has had sex with a contaminated person. So everyone has jumped on the bandwagon that it's the mosquito. So they went out and caught 20,000 mosquitoes, and none of them carried the Zika virus.
Okay, so they're not finding a high percentage. Why the panic?
Well, it is for money. First off, you got 10 people infected. The government is already sending $6 million to the city of Miami to do whatever to find this virus or control it. And it's kind of like a conspiracy type thing. The people that got bitten, none of them could show a mosquito bite. None of them remembered being bitten by a mosquito. And it's about the money.
If a woman gets bitten by a mosquito and she's pregnant, what are the odds that the baby will have this brain situation?
I have researched that the odds are anywhere from 1% to 5 in 10,000. And currently, 1,700 birth defects in 60 countries in 1 year only.
All right, Gary, thanks. Thanks for the update. Hillary Clinton emerges from her party's convention in Philadelphia with restored lead over Donald Trump, having earned a 7-point convention bounce, according to a new CNN poll. In a two-way head-to-head matchup, Clinton tops Trump 52% to 43%, and in a four-way matchup, including third-party candidates Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, Clinton leads 45 to 37 with Johnson at 9%, which is a good showing, and Stein at 5%. Tragedy over the weekend. The pilot of a hot air balloon that crashed in Texas, killing 16 people, including himself, was able to keep flying despite at least four convictions for drunken driving in Missouri and twice spending time in prison. He was in the St. Louis area. He participated in a lot of balloon matches and races there. Now, the Better Business Bureau simply said, don't book flights with this guy. I'm paraphrasing it, but that's what they said. Authorities say the balloon, which was operated by the Heart of Texas Hot Air Balloon Rides, hit a high-tension power line before crashing into a pasture Saturday about 60 miles northeast of San Antonio. What a horrible thing. They all burned to death. They can't even identify the bodies yet. NASA is planning to launch a probe to study an asteroid that they say, well, could one day pulverize the Earth. It's a long shot. The asteroid named Bennu crosses Earth's orbit every 6 years and has gotten closer since it was discovered in 1999. Should we panic? Let's check in with space historian Robert Zimmerman. Well, what do you think, Robert?
Panic is never a good solution, George.
No, sir.
It kind of defeats the purpose. Actually, this mission was interesting in that they had chosen to go to this particular asteroid before they really had a good idea of its orbit, and then discovered that it actually is one of those that's a potentially hazardous asteroid. There's about a 1 in 2,700 chance, 1 in 2,500. That it might hit the Earth sometime late in the 22nd century. This is about 170 years from now.
Well, by then we'll have the technology to knock it away.
Well, right? We hope so. I hope so. I expect so. But you got to start somewhere. And so they're sending this to do a sample return mission, which is really good. And we'll get a really good idea of the mass of the object, its makeup, how dense it is. You know, you can't just blow it up because you might end up with lots of debris coming at us. That's no good. you got to maybe move it out of the way, but then you have to have a really good idea for how what it's made of and its density
That's
and
right.
its mass. So this is what this mission will do. It's going to be very exciting over the next 2 years. It'll be really cool. It's you know, but then we'll send Bruce Willis to blow it up.
Let's hope they know what they're doing. Thanks. Robert Zimmerman, our space historian and science advisor as well. Up next, Peter Lance joins us, prolific author, researcher, investigator. He's got some great stories for us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We've got a great couple hours here for you. Peter Lance, of course, five-time Emmy-winning former ABC News correspondent, author of a number of books, highly critical of the Justice Department when it comes to their performance on counterterrorism and organized crime. He's one of the few mainstream journalists who continues to audit the Bureau, the FBI, and the Department of Justice. And, of course, he looks at threats to us. In one of his most recent works, Shadow of My Father with John Gotti Jr. Welcome back, Peter. Always good to have you on the show.
George, you are a modern-day Diogenes carrying a lantern in search of an honest man.
Let us hope it never burns out, huh?
Now, with you, it never will. And I just want to commend you at the beginning. I usually do this at the end, and then we run out of time. How important it is what you do night after night. The mainstream media just kisses the surface of the truth, and you really just plummet, George. You're the man, and I really appreciate this program.
Well, you know, we've got the resources, Peter, and our producers find great guests like you who do all the work. I mean, I'm just a facilitator and the interviewer, but I mean, you're the one that goes out there and digs and, you know, deals with some of the unscrupulous people of the world to get the information that you get. Have you ever feared for your life out there on the streets?
Well, I'm careful. You know, I have children. I'm not reckless. But, you know, I mean, I'm just, let's just say I'm careful. I don't fear for my life. But anyway, I'm just glad to be here tonight because I have a multitude of things to discuss with you, including, I hope, we get to the presidential election because I have some very compelling feelings on both sides of both the presidential nominees.
Okay, yeah, we'll definitely do that. Now, the last time you were on with me, we had John Gotti Jr. with us, the son of the legendary Gambino family boss, and you wrote right. the foreword to his memoir, Shadow of My Father. Now, we talked about the possibility of this being turned into a movie. Something's happened here, right?
Yeah, as we speak, they're shooting the film in Cincinnati, starring John Travolta as his father and Kelly Preston, John's real-life wife, as John Jr.'s mother, Victoria, and I have on my website a link to a UK Daily Mail story with great pictures from the set, and I mean, Travolta really looks the part, and it had a very tortuous history. You know, I first met John in the spring of 2011, and we were talking about doing a book together, which eventually he did on his own, and I wrote the foreword. But at the time, you know, first, you know, Nick Cassavetes was going to direct, then the great Barry Levinson, as in Bugsy and Rain Man, and, you know, and then finally Joe Johnston, and now Kevin Connolly, who played A on Entourage, is directing, and it's really exciting. It's happening. So that's John's, and that's John he's just a remarkable man. I have to tell you, I got to know him really well over the last year and a half. I never would have written the foreword if I didn't believe in his cause. He paid his dues with the Justice Department. He did, you know, paid millions in fines, 6.5 years in prison, thought that was it. And then as soon as he was about to get out, they hit him with the first of not one, not two, not three, but four federal trials, each of which ended in a hung jury, and a fifth tax investigation. And his father, they called a Teflon Don, who beat three trials and was eventually convicted. John actually prevailed five times, and finally they let him alone, and he wrote his memoir, which is quite astonishing.
Peter, does Travolta play Gotti Sr., or does he play John Gotti Jr.?
He plays Gotti Sr.,
ah.
And they have a young actor who was in Unbroken playing John Jr. in the film. So I hadn't looked at the script. I'm not really sure of the depth and breadth of it, but frankly, there's enough in Shadow of My Father to do a five-year cable series. That's how rich and deep the story is. So but since you know, we talked, I got involved in an investigation of John Alight. And if you remember, George, John Alight was the Albanian-American associate of the Gambino family that the feds used as their star witness in that trial against Junior Gotti. And he was completely, the jury said he had utterly lacked credibility. The feds tried to promote him as kind of a latter-day Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was the number two to Gotti Sr. And the guy just had no credibility. So after after the trial, he began making threats to various people, both online and then he started just basically violating the terms of the supervised release. He's on 5 years supervised release. He's in New Jersey. He's not supposed to leave the state without permission. He was doing a national book tour because he put out a book himself, his version of events. And so when I saw that he was making threats, I actually began to look into it and, proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was meeting with ex-mobsters, which is completely forbidden, that he was traveling outside the district, making threats. And so I wrote to this federal judge last fall named Susan Bucklew in Tampa, who supervises the release. And they did commence an investigation by the U.S. Probation Office, but the guy is still out there. Nobody violated him. And I think, this is my opinion, I think the reason is that he's still a coveted witness for the feds, even though he lied on the stand. And he's the FBI's version of history. So they're protecting him, and they're not enforcing the law for him the way they might for someone else. So that's one of the things that always troubles me when the law is unequally enforced. So I stayed on that story as well.
Peter, didn't the people of New York just love John Gotti Sr.?
Oh yeah. I mean, he was this larger than life guy. He went from being a driver for Carmine Sadico when he was 17 to getting on the cover of Time magazine. He was a clothes horse. His son told me, John Jr. told me that, he had this place, this beloved Bergen Hunt and Fish Club in Queens. So that's what they called it, a social club. This is before he took over as the boss and used the Ravenite Social Club in Little Italy. But he would get up in the morning. He loved to gamble, and he would get like a fat stack of $10,000, and he'd have a guy pick him up, and they'd go to that social club. He had all of his clothes laid out. He got a daily haircut by a barber at a trim, and he would play Continental for 4 or 5 hours and, do whatever he was doing in the business and the life, And then at night, he'd go to Regine's, the famous disco, or Studio 54. He'd go until the wee hours of the morning, and he'd roll in and he'd sleep most of the day, and then this would continue. But he always was there on Sunday for the family dinner. He never left the little house in Howard Beach, Queens, that he'd been with his family in for years. And he was just this really big, larger-than-life character. So I can't wait to see what Travolta does with that.
Yeah, I'm going to look forward to that. I had a guest on a few weeks ago, Peter, and he was talking about 9/11 and things that had happened. And he said, you probably don't know the name Ramzi Youssef. And I said, well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Peter Lance has mentioned that guy a lot of times in that Bojinka situation. And I mean, it's great to know these people and some of the players that have been involved in just about everything that you've worked in.
Well, George, what my job is, I see my role as auditor of the FBI and the Justice Department. That's my unofficial role as a journalist. And just because they have their version of history. And, he who wins the wars writes the history books, right? But the problem is, if as Santiago said, George Santiano, if we don't remember history, we are destined to relive it. We don't remember the faults and the mistakes, right? And so, for example, to me, one of the most catastrophic blunders of all time was the obsession of the New York office of the FBI with getting Gotti, this FBI forever bothering Italians. Now, whatever you want to say about the damage done by organized crime, and I'm not trying to minimize it, they control the construction industry. People paid extra for virtually everything in New York because of the mob. Nothing compares to what was done to our country in 9/11, right? I mean, it's not even close.
That's
right.
So
what happened, and I have a kind of a famous HuffPost I wrote called Al-Qaeda and the Mob, How the FBI Blew It on 9/11, and it's on my website, peterlance.com. And basically what I'm arguing is this obsession caused them to take their eye off a metastasizing Al-Qaeda cell. And I proved in my first book, 1,000 Years for Revenge, George, and how many years ago? I was on with you in 2003 when that book came out, right?
Yep.
And if you recall, what I argued at that point was that the original 1993 World Trade Center bombing cell was identical to the cell that did the 9/11 plot, and it was funded by bin Laden, and that Ramzi Youssef had basically conceived the planes as missiles plot in the Philippines after fleeing New York. And Dan Rather was the only mainstream journalist who gave me credibility. He had two nights in a row on the CBS Evening News from Iraq himself reporting on my book. New York Times, oh, no, we don't believe it. None of the mainstream media treated it seriously. Well, guess what, George? In 2010, the FBI, the Southern District of New York, the federal prosecutors, which is the office that beget Rudy Giuliani and Louis Frey, the best and the brightest, they modified the superseding indictment on Ramzi Youssef for the Trade Center bombing to include his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for 9/11 and all those murders. So I was vindicated. Now, you'd think a story like that should go across the front page of the New York Times, above the fold, banner headline, right? Because it proves that for years, that particularly the FBI, was grossly negligent in not connecting these dots. The 9/11 Commission denied it. Patrick Fitzgerald denied it. You know, I mean, it's just, yeah, but okay, so then they finally admit it. Guess what? The story is buried on the inside of the New York Times. And here's my conclusion. Media institutions like the great New York Times, and it is the greatest paper in America, and I look forward to that little blue package on my doorstep every morning. I mean, it's the New York Times, right?
So, you're not just an online guy anymore, huh?
Oh, no. I like to have that paper, move that paper through my fingers in the morning.
All right.
Get that ink on my head.
It's a dying breed, though, isn't it, Peter?
We're all a dying breed.
<That's>
but I started out in print, and so I like to see it. All of my books are available online and all that. And
sure.
Books, but I agree. Cut two. But here's the thing, okay? What I'm trying to say is media institutions like the New York Times are as adverse to admitting fault as government institutions are. Nobody wants to admit that they blew it on any significant subject, right? Particularly the paper of record, the New York Times. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is I'm out there every day, and if there's another story that comes out where I have a unique view of history on, I try and set the record straight. And I've done that in a couple of things which we can talk about recently. And I write a lot of HuffPost. The Huffington Post regularly runs my work. And I write for the Santa Barbara News Press. I live in Santa Barbara. So anyway, I can take you through a few of the things I've been doing.
Yeah, what have you been doing lately?
Okay, well, first of all, and all of this is on my website, but recently, remember the famous 1964 terrible Goodwin, Schwerner, and Cheney, the three civil rights workers in Mississippi that were kidnapped by the Klan, and they were tortured and murdered, and they were buried ultimately under an earthen dam. It was this huge scandal at the time. Lyndon Johnson, was trying to get civil rights legislation passed, and Hoover, he was putting pressure on Hoover to break the case.
There was a movie on that. They made a movie about that.
Mississippi Burning.
That's right.
Famous movie with Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe. Okay?
That's right.
Now, okay, here's the thing. The movie, they finally get the location of the bodies of the three civil rights workers from an African-American agent who flies down and supposedly gets it out of one of the Klan guys. Well, first of all, there were probably a half dozen African-American agents in 64 to begin with. That's not how it happened. How it happened is with our old friend who I talked to you about, Gregory Scarpa Sr., who was a mad dog killer for the Colombo crime family, and I wrote about him in my book Cover Up in 2004 and in my latest book, Deal with the Devil. I tell the full Scarpa story. And Hoover, he'd been a top echelon criminal informant, like Whitey Bulger, same level, only 10 times more lethal and dangerous than Whitey Bulger.
Yeah.
This guy, they called him the Mad Hatter and the Killing Machine. Hoover sends him down. He kidnaps the mayor of a local town who's a Klan associate and tortures the guy. I mean, literally tortures the guy into giving up the location. Now, recently, the FBI issued its definitive report on it, and they closed the case in Mississippi after 52 years based on the FBI report. They mentioned an informant. Of course they don't say it was Greg Scarpa because they don't want to admit that they used a mad dog killer. So Peter Lance, I filed my little minority report at peterlance.com. And I prove it, and I have documents to prove it. So that's an example of the kind of thing that I try and do.
Scarpa was involved in just about everything, wasn't he?
He was a brilliant Machiavellian chess player who manipulated, first of all, he became an informant in 1962. And as I say in the book, Deal with the Devil, many of the facts that Joseph Valachi, the famous mob canary, the first guy who sang before the McClellan Committee, remember in the early 60s, 1963, Joseph Valachi? Okay. Valachi was always thought to be a low-level knuckle-dragger. How does he know all this stuff? Well, he knew it because Scarpa Sr. was feeding it to Hoover ahead of time, and it came through the mouth of Valachi.
Hold on for a second, Peter. We're already at the break. Fast half hour. We'll be back with more. We'll pick it up with there and so much more to talk with him about, including terrorism, what's going on there. We'll get his take on the two presidential candidates, the two main presidential candidates, because there are others. Sure is, with our special guest, Peter Lance. We're going to come back with Peter and talk more about his incredible work. His website, peterlance.com, where you can track a lot of the things we're talking about in depth, by the way. So there are 59 seats left on the bottom level in Asheville, North Carolina. The rest will be up in the balcony. So take advantage of it. Go to the website, coasttocoastam.com. Click the highlight reel. You'll see the picture of the Asheville event. And if you're in the greater area, but come on from anywhere. I mean, we're going to have some fun there for a full night with a meet and greet afterwards. Just come on out. But you have to click the Asheville button at coasttocoastam.com. It'll take you straight to the theater's website. And just keep looking for the date, August 27th, because that'll get you and maneuver you through the tickets. But only 59 seats left on the bottom level. If not, you're going to the balcony. And welcome back to Coast, Peter Lance with us. Peter, Greg Scarpa Jr. died, a senior, died on my birthday in 1994. Strange coincidence, but there are no coincidences.
Well, he died of AIDS, and that's a whole story into itself as to how he had a version of how he contracted AIDS. But he was about as purely evil as you can get. He bragged once to Larry Mazza, who was like his killing assistant, that he stopped counting after 50 murders, which would have made him, George, not just one of the largest killers in mafia history, but one of the most prolific serial killers in American history. And he literally was working for the FBI. I calculated that between 1962, they closed him for 5 years in the 70s, but then they opened him all the way through the mid-90s, that they paid him the equivalent of $1 million in 2013, currency. And he played them like a concert pianist. I mean, he would use the Bureau intelligence to either knock off his rivals or get them indicted. And he rose to the boss level of the family. Carmine Persico was the titular boss, but he was locked up in Lompoc Federal Prison. And Greg was basically running with reckless abandon the family. And the third Colombo War, the Colombos were the most violent of all the families, even though they only had 130-some made guys compared to over 200 in the Gambino, Dottie's family. And yet they had three incredible wars over the course of 15 or 20 years. And we now know why, because they had an agent provocateur in their midst. And the third war in Brooklyn in the early 90s, like 14 people were killed, a number of innocent bystanders wounded, and Scarpa literally waged the war himself with the advice and consent of his bureau handler, R. Lindley DeVecchio. Now, why did DeVecchio state, whereas John Connolly, who was Whitey Bulger's contacting agent, end up in prison? I contend that Lynn DeVecchio, who was actually Rudy Giuliani, made him the case agent in the Mafia Commission case in the mid-80s, and that's the case that propelled Rudy into Gracie Mansion. So he took this guy, Lynn DeVecchio, who was a kind of a white-bread Italian from Fresno, an army brat, and basically, anointed him, and so he could not go down, because if Lynn DeVecchio went down, and he was indicted for murder, there was a short murder trial, if you remember, in Brooklyn, and in the fall of 2007, it ended abruptly, and Lynn is now in Florida clipping his coupons and riding his Harley, whereas John Connolly, his counterpart in Boston, ended up in prison. It's just a fabulous, fascinating story. It's the Whitey Bulger story on steroids.
I had a chance to watch the Johnny Depp movie a few weeks ago, and he did a good job portraying Whitey.
I thought he was brilliant. I thought he just absolutely got... He had the Boston accent down. I'm from Rhode Island, so it took me years to lose the accent, which is worse. It's halfway between Brooklyn and Boston, the Rhode Island accent. Everything's wicked. It's wicked cool in Rhode Island, But yeah, I thought he was absolutely devastating. And they're supposed to be making a movie with that Nick Coleggi, my friend, wrote the script for, starring Sylvester Stallone as Scarpa.
Huh.
And I'm hoping that my book will be adapted as a cable series, because there's, again,
oh, that would
enough
be
in
great.
It to run for years. Yeah,
that would be so. Great. You have looked at a lot of things that the FBI has looked at in terms of individuals who have subsequently committed some atrocities. And they've known them, they've talked to them, they've investigated them, and then they don't do anything, and then all of a sudden these people go ballistic. Case in point, this Orlando nightclub massacre.
Absolutely. And but before I get there, let me just throw in the quintessential kind of example of
all
what
right.
you're talking about in the 28 pages, the famous or the infamous 28 missing pages, remember, from the Joint Inquiries Congressional Report.
About the Saudis? Yeah.
About the Saudis, yeah. Those pages were redacted. If you read the original report, it's on my website. It's right on the homepage, peterlance.com. And you'll see the page 415 through 429, whatever it is. And they're basically blank pages. Now when you look at the new, there's still some redaction, but when you listen to this quote, now we know why they didn't find anything, any smoking gun about the Saudis. Listen to this real quick, George. It says, the blood, now newly restored, it says, one reason for the limited understanding of the Saudis is that it was only after September 11th that the U.S. government began to aggressively investigate this issue. Prior to September 11th, the FBI apparently did not focus investigative resources on Saudi nationals in the U.S. due to their status as an American ally. In other words, the Bureau wasn't looking, which is why they don't have any smoking gun in the report. And remember, I know you'll remember this, George, because right after 9/11, when none of us could fly, nobody could get on a plane, no citizen, the Bin Laden family members that were in the U.S. were spirited out of the country.
That's right.
Okay?
That day.
Right. Yeah, and the FBI helped in that. Now, let's go to, and you're going to hear tonight, you're going to hear me go after Clinton with reckless abandon in a little while. So this is, I'm an equal opportunity critic, okay? So don't let the Republicans in your audience shut down what I'm about to say. But during the Bush administration, the Bushes were famously close to the Saudi family. And Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., they called him Bandar Bush. He had like a nickname.
Yeah.
All right? Now, Khalid Al-Madar and Nawaf El-Hazmi, these two guys, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, okay? And two of those that flew AA-77 into the Pentagon, Al-Madar and El-Hazmi, were basically on the radar of the NSA like a year and a half before 9/11.
Jeez.
They ended up coming to the United States. They were at the famous 9/11 planning session in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, that was highly surveilled by various intelligence services. They get past the watch list, they come to the United States, they go to San Diego, and they end up being kind of sponsored by a Saudi named Omar Bayoumi, who had ties, it is said, to Prince Bandar's wife, through a foundation that benefited this guy, Bayoumi, okay? Now, these two terrorists were highly visible, George. They bought a car for $3,000, registered it with the DMV. Al-Hazmi had his name in the phone directory, published in the phone directory with his phone number. They used to go to SeaWorld. They took flying lessons. I mean, they were highly visible in both San Diego and then eventually New York. Now, listen to this. I am not making this up, okay? Al-Madar and Al-Hazmi, and these are all guys that could have been in the FBI, could have reported on for the joint inquiry. Why? Because there was a guy named Abdusadr Sheikh, who was an FBI informant who was interacting with these guys in San Diego. So the Bureau can't go the old, see no evil, hear no evil, stovepiping thing, because they had a guy working for them as an informant who was interacting with them. Now, where do you think these guys got their fake IDs that allowed them to get on American 77 and fly it into the Pentagon? Where do you think they got their fake IDs?
Don't say from us. Feds.
No, but like, let's take one step back. There is a mailbox checking store in Jersey City called Sphinx Trading, like the Egyptian Sphinx, run by two Egyptians, okay? And there are three dots on the chart that will blow your mind. And everything I'm telling you is absolutely true. It's all documented in my work. It's on my website. Dot number one, after the murder of Meir Kahane in 1990 by El Sayed Nasser, another Egyptian, who was one of the members of the original World Trade Center bombing cell, they realized, the Fed, that he had a mailbox at this place called Sphinx Trading. So that's dot number one, okay? Dot number two, when Patrick Fitzgerald and Andy McCarthy did what was called the Day of Terror case, the plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels, which was the second major Al-Qaeda-related case after the 93 bombing.
Okay? All right, and what year would that have been?
That was, the indictment was in 94, the trial was in 95.
Okay.
All right, they had a list of 172 unindicted co-conspirators in that case, and one of them was called Waleed al-Noor, N-O-O-R, and all of this stuff is online, and it's on my website.
No, okay? No relation to me.
No. Waleed al-Noor. And Waleed al-Noor was the co-founder of Sphinx Trading, was an unindicted co-conspirator on a list with bin Laden, Ali Muhammad, the master spy, you know, all the big all-stars of al-Qaeda, all right? That's dot number two. So this guy is a co-incorporator of Sphinx Trading that the feds have known about for several years, because of the murder of Kahane. Here's the drum roll, and this is the big one. In the summer of 2001, in July, right around the time of the famous Phoenix memo, okay, saying that they should be looking at flight schools, Al-Madar and Ohazmi get their fake IDs at Sphinx Trading. They pick them up at Sphinx Trading, and they're issued by a guy named Muhammad Al-Atras, who's the partner of Waleed al-Noor. So what I say in this piece they did on the HuffPost, is if the FBI had devoted 5% of the surveillance resources they devoted to the Ravenite Social Club watching John Gotti 24/7 around the clock, if they'd given 5% of their surveillance resources and set up what they call a perch or a plant across the street from Sphinx Trading that they'd known about, but by the way, you know what it was? It was right under the blind sheikh's mosque, the mosque of the Prince of Jihad, Omar Abdel Rahman, the blind sheikh who was convicted in that very day of terror.
He's still alive, isn't he?
He's still alive. Right? Yeah, he's still alive, and he tried. And Morsi, and he got word from prison. If you remember, one of my closest friends is Ahmed Salem, this wonderful Egyptian-American ex-intelligence officer who came to America, became a citizen, helped the FBI, almost stopped the first bombing, and he's the one that went back after the 93 bombing and got the sheikh, rounded up the sheikh and all these others in the day. He risked his life. He was in witness protection 14 years, contacted me when he got out. We're the best of friends, okay? And basically, he warned the FBI about the blind sheikh and this nest of vipers, as he put it. So the feds were onto this place, and all they had to do, and they would have walked right in the middle of the 9/11 plot. Remember, Condi Rice was saying there was chatter that summer, there's all this stuff going on, this Phoenix memo, this confluence of intelligence coming in, something big's about to happen. They would have had the plot in their hands, but they were obsessed with getting Gotti, and they didn't have a plant across the street from Sphinx Trading.
Peter, your work is remarkable, and some of these stories that happen, you shake your head, because in so many cases, we probably could have uncovered them and stopped them, couldn't we?
Absolutely. In fact, Ahmed Salem has, I did a Playboy piece, I've done three pieces for Playboy, where they do have articles in that. I don't even think they have pictures anymore, right? They just have, I sound like Donald Trump the way I'm talking. They famously have articles that everybody used to make a joke about Playboy. But they had some wonderful investigative pieces over the years. And I did one on this amazing guy, Ahmed Salem. After he got out of witness protection, he approached me. I was speaking at NYU in New York in 2009. He contacted me. We got together. And he and I and a former Brooklyn South homicide detective named James Moss, an incredible cop, the three of us, broke a 19-year-old unsolved cold case of a murder involving Mustafa Chalabi, who was the imam of the Al-Farouq Mosque in Brooklyn, who was murdered in the most violent, bloody way you could imagine. And we broke that case, and I wrote about it in Playboy. And in that article, Ahmed Salem says, he basically says that his FBI, he warned the FBI, like, that there was something big is going to happen. He had to withdraw because a new head of terrorism came in and forced him to wear a wire, and he was sleeping on the floors of mosques. I can't do that. So on his last meeting, was his FBI contacting agent, Nancy Floyd, who was this incredible agent who almost stopped the 93 bombing. he says, Nancy, whatever you do, follow. And he gives him the name of two guys that were working with Yusuf in New Jersey. Just follow these two guys, and you will be in the middle of the plot. And if you do not do this, Nancy, don't call me when the bombs go off. He thought it was going to be more than one. And, of course, Nancy had been sidelined at the time, and they weren't listening to her anymore as much as she tried. And so, sure enough, they could have stopped the bomb. And years later, John Antisev, a tape surface in which John Antisev, who was one of Imed's handlers, Imed says to him, because he mistrusted the FBI so much he staked the FBI in addition to the bad guys, right, to kind of cover himself so he didn't get blamed for the bombing. And he says to John Antisev, you know, we could have stopped 9/11, the bombing.
Unbelievable.
And Antisev says, yeah, I know, but don't tell anybody. And I mean, it's on tape.
And you find these things. How come other mainstream media folks don't, Peter? We don't hear this unless it's from you.
Well, there are a lot of great investigative reporters out there. I think Glenn Greenwald is one, the guy that dealt with Snowden. He has a thing called The Intercept now. There's a lot of great reporters, but it's an endangered species. I'm an old line shoe leather investigator. I never did journalism from a phone in an office. I get out in the field and I talk to people, okay? And I met Imed Salem because I was the only one that wrote honestly about him. And that's why he wanted to meet me, and we hit it off, you know, brother to brother. You know what I'm saying? It's like we connected as human beings, as men. And that's why he trusted me to go to the next level. And so, you know, I'm kind of an old school guy. I mean, for better or worse. Getting older by the day.
Good
so anyway, but so ask me another question. You were talking about, Orlando. Do you want to get into that?
Let's get into Orlando for a little bit, then we'll get into some other. We're almost at the top of the hour, and I definitely want to take your thoughts on the presidential election. But the Orlando situation, which, again, another bizarre situation.
Yeah, look, here's what came out after Orlando, that the FBI had been investigating Omar Mateen twice and basically gave him a pass, right? And we know that they were warned about the Chinaya brothers in Boston. And we know, I actually found this in the heart of my source, was the New York Times. Remember that line in Dr. Strangelove?
Yeah.
The New York Times, after Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, in May of 2010, planted a weapon of mass destruction in Times Square on a Saturday night, and the good old NYPD wrapped him up in 48 hours. If you drill down on the reporting, you find out that actually the Joint Terrorism Task Force in 2004, 6 years earlier, had interviewed George LaMonica, a computer consultant who bought the condo of Shahzad. And he's talking about this guy. Now, how did they lose track of him? How did he go to South Waziristan, get the skill to build a WMD, build it within 30 miles of New York and park it in Times Square on a Saturday night, and there was for the grace of God and a bystander, so that was tragedy was averted, okay? So that's another one. And it's just the reason I say, and I'll make it very quick, there are two big reasons. One, the FBI for years spent millions and millions on what they call the virtual case file system. You watch movies, you think, oh, my God, the Bureau, they can just pick up an iPhone and type in a name, and boom, and they're going to get Zoom all over the world and track it. No. After 9/11, they had the facts. Literally, I mean, not facts, they had to FedEx pictures of the 19 hijackers to all the regional offices around the country because they couldn't even attach them as emails. So they spent millions of dollars on a thing first called Trilogy, and that was a boondoggle. Then they had a thing called Sentinel, and Sentinel was hundreds of millions of dollars more, and it didn't go online until 2012, and even now it's questionable whether it works. And who do you think was at Lockheed Martin, which had the contract for that, as general counsel? None other than James Comey. Who's he? He's the current FBI director.
That's right.
He's a former Justice Department heavyweight, big friend of Patrick Fitzgerald. He leads the DOJ, gets a major job, General Counsel Lockheed, right around the time they get this contract. And then he gets back revolving door to the FBI. So what I'm trying to say, so that's one problem, the fact that I don't even think they want to connect the dots in their own because they're afraid of what would fly out of those files from the days of Hoover forward. The other problem is lack of translators in the language of the enemy. When I did a deal with the devil in 2012, I went back and I asked the Bureau how many actual agents they have that speak Farsi, Urdu, Arabic, you know, the language of jihadists. And they basically said something like 380, all right? Well, that's less than 2% of the 5,000 agents working terrorism. So you add the fact that they don't have the capabilities that you and I might have if we had an iMac or a cranked up Windows machine, okay? And then you have the fact that none of the people they have really authoritatively speak the language. And then you find out that most of the terrorism cases, 90% that they've made almost 1,000, are all local, low-level guys in a mosque, disgruntled. And so the FBI sends undercover agents in, give them money, give them the means to do the plot, and they indict them. And they go, oh, we've had 900 and some terrorism indictments. No, they're just low-level wannabes.
All right, up next, Peter Lentz has some inside information on Hillary and on Donald. That's next.